Who wants to go first? I'm going to come out to the crowd with a microphone. Don't say a word yet.
Hi, I'm Sandy. I'm from Cincinnati, and I have a question for the Columbus folks. I'm very interested in hearing how your organization got to the digital experience concept.
Hi, Sandy. We actually started what we call the Virtual Librarian Program about 4 or 5 years ago. I was part of that. We took staff from our public services department and had them work in IT for about 20 hours a week. We then ended up, we took those three people, myself being one of them, and we formed the virtual branch, and that went on for about 2 years. And then Helen Blowers came on board to Columbus, and she's very much into, you know, our customers and our users and the whole digital experience. So when the digital services department was created that she is head of, she really wanted a group that was very much centered on usability, how the customer relates to our website, and what we do to offer programs and technology to our users. So it kind of came about from, you know, just taking people from public services because, you know, they tend to be, they're the people that are using all the technology that IT creates. And we sort of bridged that gap between public services and IT as a result. And to this day, you know, because I was 15 years in public services, we still have people that see us as that friendly face on IT, you know. And so that's sort of how that came about. Did that answer your question? Okay.
Who's next? Here we go.
Thank you, sir. My name is Dara, and I'm from Park Ridge, Illinois. And Nancy's not here, which is a shame because I had a question about a quote that she had up on the screen earlier today. It was, "Our job is not to convince people they need libraries. It is to convince libraries they need people." I was just curious what all of you thought about that quote. Does that mean, what I took from it was that the major obstacle that we face in implementing a more 2.0 user-centered model of service is convincing librarians that it's not all about them, that it's more about service to the public? And if that is the case, how do we accomplish that paradigm shift?
Awesome question. I want to hear from all of you.
Could you repeat the quote? I wasn't here for Nancy's.
Yes. Yes, I think I do have it, or at least a paraphrase. The quote was, "The job is not to convince people that they need the library. It's to convince the library that they need people."
I'll just go ahead and start it off. I think that's the whole reason why we do what we do. If the customer doesn't find the value in the library and the library doesn't realize how important that customer is, I don't think we accomplish much of anything. I think it's important for our staff to be empowered so that they can understand what our websites are doing, what our services are that we offer, and then you have them go out and convey that message to the customer, and hopefully by putting a friendly face on it, that will help the customer, you know, interact more with the library. Our marketing department went around last year and took pictures of our staff, and we use those pictures on our website every day, on our homepage especially. We have a featured book that we put up there, and it's got a staff member's face tied to it, and a lot of times that staff member has chosen that title. And what they find is they'll be at their location, because, you know, these are staff from all across the system. They'll be at their location and somebody will say, you know, maybe they're working the information desk, and someone will say, "Hey, I saw you on the website. Did you really read that book?" And so by doing that, I think, you know, it puts that friendly face. It makes us more approachable. And I think by being more approachable, the customers really appreciate the fact that we're human also. We're just people. And when they want that information, that they feel comfortable asking us about things.
I think building on that, it's important to keep in mind that there's Google and Wikipedia out there. A lot of people don't believe they need libraries anymore. But, you know, we could become irrelevant if we're not on top of the technologies that we have out there today. So I think that's very important to keep that in mind. For example, my son is 14 years old, and The only reason he goes to the library is to get books. So he says, well, what do I need the library for other than books? Well, because he's my son, naturally, I said, well, you know, you can use this for researching, among many other things. You can get, you know, latest news, all kinds of features that the library has. Electronic resources, for example, is a huge way to communicate to people the services that we provide. So I think when you ask the question, I think that's definitely the key. You're right in that libraries, you know, I believe need people more than people need libraries.
Well, I wasn't at Nancy's presentation this morning, so I'm taking it a little out of context, but what it means to me, it sounds like she's talking about buy-in, okay, but not just this sort of arbitrary, yeah, we buy into the mission, but the real kind of emotional buy-in that, you know, rests in your core and actually affects the way that you do things. And to me, it's not an either or on those two things. I think they're both important, but that you can't have people needing libraries until the folks in those libraries understand the need for people. You know, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think they play together. So.
That was a solid liberal arts, none of the above answer. I like it. No, for real. Go ahead, sir.
Okay, so when I hear that, I just think about the fact that libraries do not look at user information very much, user metrics. We don't do a lot based on what our users are telling us they need. When people say we're doing something wrong or they want something done differently, we think they're annoying and we just kind of shove them to the side. And instead of paying attention and saying, well, if one person thinks this, maybe there are more and we should check into that. When I hear that, I just think that it's a shift in refocusing and doing, you know, hard studies, you know, looking like the last presentation and actually getting some numbers to back up what we think's going on and to actually listen to what our users tell us is and is not important to them. We just did a study for our website redesign process, and the technologies that our staff thought that the users would be requesting was not at all what they were actually asking us to have. So I think that if we do refocus that, and I think the way to get that is to train staff in statistics, to train them in customer service, and then to hire people with a user-centered, customer-focused mind, to have some interview questions focusing on that aspect of what we do day-to-day, because it's often not, you know, reflected in the job ad, it's not reflected in the interview process, that you do need to be user-centered, and the more that we can do that, and when we bring new people in, the better off we'll be long-term.
Thinking of what user assisting libraries is actually the complete base of what I'm doing as a designer. When I have to design something for a library, it's always based on who's going to use it. So all the things we're looking at DOC is, in a small example, if you get elderly people who can't physically come to the library, we go at them and we deliver the books, we deliver the website, we deliver them the stuff they want from the library. It's the whole time you have to look who your user is, understand them, what is the interest, what do they do when they're not going to the library, and is there something that when they do it, what's not linked to the library, let's say ordering books at Amazon, is it something, could you put it in the library? Try to understand the whole time. If you don't do that, you need the people in the library.
Well, being last, I'll probably just paraphrase everybody else. But I think it does come down to remembering why the library is here. We're not here to promote whatever, you know, crazy commie pingo librarian agendas we have. We're here to react to the user needs. I think it can also be turned, I think the libraries, people don't need libraries, libraries need people, can be turned more inward, which we tend to do because we focus on our own navels a lot in this profession. But in terms of we need people working in the library that are responsive to that.
Yes, similarly to that, and since I gave part of a presentation today, I guess I can talk too, right? I would say that I would change the phrase a little bit, and I'd say we don't need to convince people that they need the library. We need to convince the library that the library is made of people, and I think that's what you were getting at for sure. Okay, next up.
Hey, guys. Greg, I really enjoyed your presentation on personal brand. And I've been thinking a lot in libraries about how libraries brand themselves personally, because community is the only thing that separates my library from your library, from your library, from your library. So my question is, in looking at branding in libraries, in digital space and social media, what are your top tips for creating a personal library brand? And I can throw that open to all of you, Sarah, Joy, Sam, everyone up there.
This is so easy for me because it's really the same six tips I gave all of the folks who were in the audience about personal branding. I think everything I said really translates back, right? I talked about having a home base. Well, most libraries already do that, you'd like to think. Not all of them. Remember, digital divide's still very real. A lot of libraries actually don't have a web presence, believe it or not. Let's see what else I talk about. Joining the conversation. You know, something that still a library needs to do with an authentic voice. You know, I think that came up in other presentations in this track today. You know, I talked about aggregating, you know, your life stream. Well, I still think that's, again, very relevant. You know, libraries do these things where they have these separate blogs for different events, and then they fail to rebring all of those pieces and chunks back together to unify, you know, the sort of online presence, the online identity of the library. And being authentic. I mean, how can you argue with being authentic as a thing that a library can do to not only humanize the library, but establish consistent voice across all of those things? Say, we're really people, we're really here. We're not just a website. We're not just, you know, the sort of abstract entity that there's people behind these things. So I'm going to say refer to my slides as an excellent way to get my tips. And I'm thinking that folks here are going to have other things to add to that. So,
I got nothing.
Or not.
I got nothing.
Say who they are.
Hi, I'm
Greg.
Yeah,
that's true. Not everyone's been here all day. So why don't we have some quick introductions?
I'll start. I'm Greg Schwartz. I'm the library systems manager for the Louisville Free Public Library, which means I'm a library guy in an IT department rather than vice versa.
And I am Sam Davis. I'm an application solutions architect for the Columbus Metropolitan Library. I am essentially an IT guy in the library world.
You should really fight.
My name is Joy Marlowe, and I'm a digital experience analyst for the Columbus Metropolitan Library. And I actually have my background in public services. I worked there for 15 years. So I guess I'm a library person who still has some public services but is doing a lot of technology, too.
I'm Sarah Houghton-Jan, the Digital Futures Manager for the San Jose Public Library.
Hey, I'm Geert van den Bogart. I work as a designer for the DOC, the library in Delft, and actually I'm always looking at new ways how to get people in contact and in touch with a local library.
I'm Zeth Litzau. I'm the Associate Director of the Library Research Service, so I guess I'm a librarian who works with numbers.
Okay, who's up next? You almost raised your hand and back. No?
That's just a scratch.
Anyone? Yes, here we go. Got a couple.
This might be a little specific, but if anyone has anything they want to talk about, we've been looking at doing text messaging reference at our library. So if anyone has any particular tips, tricks, or any assistance on that, that's what we're really looking at right now.
My tip would be to check out the company that I mentioned in the presentation Aaron and I did, which is Mozio, their text-to-librarian service, because it does fold in instant messaging and text messaging into one. And as I stated, they are either developing or they've completed at this point a queuing system as well, where you can have multiple librarians monitoring a single input, a single screen name, which is a recipe for the building of consortia for text messaging and IM reference. So I'm very excited about that. That would be my suggestion. I would also say if you're thinking about doing it in your library, survey your users first to see if this is something that they want and that they'll use. I've heard from a few libraries that have started the service and they've gotten almost no use even though they thought it would be off the charts. Whenever you're going to invest a significant amount of money, you know, just get some data first.
And that's MOSIO, is that right?
Yes.
There's also another application out there called Library Help, I believe it's called. It's actually an IM client primarily, but it does have the capability of doing texting, and we're actually evaluating that currently.
And I'll also add, for a really quick and dirty way, you can send text messages to people's phones through an email address from their carrier, so their cell phone number at AT&T.com, et cetera, or Verizon.net, and that will actually send a text message to their phone through email, so you could enter that into the ILS for their email address, and it would send as a text. It's kind of a cheating way, but it works. How to do that? Okay, so let's say I was at my computer and I wanted to send a text message to your phone. I could type in your phone number at yourcarrier.com, and even though it would go through email, it would route a message to your phone.
Then they would have your email to text you.
Yeah, that's pretty much a one-way thing that a library could do for, say, holds notification or overdue notification. Yeah. And Gear?
Yeah. I will add something with the Bluetooth technology. That's actually quite a cheap version. You need a Bluetooth sender. It will cost you about $1,000. And probably you need to develop some software, but you're not paying for sending and receiving the messages. That can make a big difference in the money you have to put in. And I think in Europe, the Bluetooth is available on most telephones. I'm not sure if that's also the same in the U.S., but it could be going up to someone that you can use that type of technology to send your message.
Jot, the voice to text recognition thing. I don't know, does that text message you? Here, why don't you make a comment?
Tell us about it. Well, I don't know much about it. I just know it exists because I keep getting Jot messages from a friend. And they just hits his voicemail and it goes into the... to my text. I get a text from him. So I thought that might be an interesting way to do.
Yes, Jot.com will take voice, transcribes it into digital text, and sends it to your friends or to on their phones or their email. It's pretty nifty. I think Sarah uses it quite a bit.
Yeah, I have a two-hour each-way commute, so I use Jot to write emails, to write reports, to do all sorts of things while I'm driving. But it is a really good tool, and it is very accurate in its transcription of your voice. If you are going to use it, you can have the free version, and then there are subscription models as well. If you have something where you think, oh, yeah, voice-to-text would be helpful as a quick way to send someone a message, either, as everyone's saying, I mean, email or text, whatever is more convenient for them, I highly recommend just looking at it and trying it and seeing if it works for you, either professionally for your library or maybe even just for yourself.
Have you heard of Evernote? Evernote, you take a picture and it goes up on the Internet, and it's a way to access data. Anybody ever heard of that? I've just seen it, Evernote.
Yeah, Evernote's really useful for being at presentations, or if you do a lot of meetings, you can take a picture and send that picture of, say, the blackboard that you're using for your meeting, and you can send it to yourself and pull it up at any time to keep track of your notes. It's basically a digital way of keeping your notes digitally.
You guys still using blackboards in Columbus?
Well, what I meant by dry erase boards.
I'm joking.
Jeez, brutal crown.
He's on the panel.
Hello. For someone that does not have a presence on the web, really, or a personal brand, mainly because I'm just apprehensive about having all my info out there, can you guys address why I should or should not be apprehensive about that?
It's an excellent question. And I don't know that there are any easy answers to it, in that... really, it's going to depend at some degree on on your comfort level. I can say from my own experience that I was very guarded about personal info early on. Started my blog thinking nobody would ever notice it, that I would just sort of do this thing. It would be an experiment with the technology. I would get some sort of, you know, satisfaction out of having said, okay, I tried that. Not a week after I started blogging, this is in 2003, so there are far fewer folks paying attention to this stuff in library land at that point. Less than a week later, a link to my blog showed up on another fairly high-profile library blog at the time. And the next thing I knew, I was just sort of sucked into what we now call maybe the biblioblogosphere, or this whole community of people blogging and interacting online, which I found very exhilarating. And so I ultimately just came to embrace it and found that the positives of being out there, putting my name out there, the kinds of opportunities that started coming my way, particularly when I started podcasting, I was kind of early on that trend. And suddenly, because people knew who I was and what I was doing, created all sorts of opportunities. It's in large part why I'm sitting on this stage now. And I think that the trade-off of that, for what limited information I was really revealing about myself, and now I'm a lot faster and looser with that kind of stuff, and I'm not nearly as guarded in general, having just chosen to kind of own all of that stuff and embrace it. But I don't think it's necessarily an all-or-nothing proposition. I don't think that one has to sort of start putting their cell phone number online, as, you know, you don't have to take it to that level. But I don't think there's really any, I don't see any reason to really be afraid. I never had anything negative come of having a blog with my name on it. Now, I mean, depending on the kinds of things you're likely to say on such an online presence, maybe there's a good reason to operate under pseudonym or anonymously or whatnot. That's not the direction I took. And I've never had any reason to regret any part of sort of putting myself out there and being part of the online conversation.
I think you also have to think about why you're doing it, if it's to interact with your friends and family, because that's how they choose to communicate, and that's going to allow you to expand your life or your social life or get more information or have new professional opportunities. I mean, think about the desire that's driving putting yourself online and where. But I mean, I would say be very careful at first, much as Greg was. I think some of us made some mistakes early on by putting too much information on. I had accidentally once posted a PDF of my resume that had my home address on it, and received a stalker-ish incident about a month later that scared the crap out of me. And I said, oh, dear. And I've been very, very conscious now about not putting my home address, my home phone number, you know, my anything that could let people find me physically. Like, you can find me physically here at the conference. That's cool. But, like, when I'm home with my husband and my cat, I want that life to be mine and to be separate. And I think you do have to define where that line is between your professional identity and your personal identity and how those mesh online, because they will, and where you're going to draw that line for yourself in your own life, because it'll end up somewhere. But that's a choice everyone has to make individually.
I'd add that it's essential for us to get online as librarians, I guess not only because we need to have a personal understanding of it to fully exploit it professionally, but also because it's going to be totally essential to participate in the future, really. We're not going to be able to be full participants of, I think, a democracy without being able to put content online and contribute content. And I would really read the report by Henry Jenkins, Confronting the Challenges of the 21st Century. There's a free PDF online. There's an executive summary. It's really good. And he states that, you know, the digital divide will be solved, but in the future there are going to be people who know how to navigate all this and operate and do all this participatory culture, and there's going to be people that don't know how to do it. And the gap in between he calls the participation gap. And it's really crucial that librarians are on the, I guess, information halves of this gap so we can lead other people through this. Okay, next question.
I think we need to be clear about blogging as an individual and blogging as a representative of your jurisdiction. As an administrator, that would be something I might be concerned about. If you were putting yourself out there too personally, there could be liability if you're doing it through the library's website. So I think that's something that needs to be considered and talked about separately.
I think judgment is always at play. You know, but yeah, I've actually never blogged in a professional context in that way as part of my job. But yeah, I mean, I would think judgment would prevail, you know, in one would hope. Exactly. And that's, I mean, not always going to be the case. But yes, exercising judgment in what you put online, what you say, how you say it, who the audience is, all of that kind of stuff. Assume things are going to be there forever. You know, that would be one tip. You're going to put something up there and, yeah, you might delete it. You might unpublish the blog post that you put up, you know, after second thought. But Google caches pretty quickly. And, you know, the Wayback Machine holds things for a real long time. So definitely better to use the judgment before you put something up rather than after.
Got a question?
Hi, who are you?
My name is Laura, and I'm from Santa Clara County Library. It's a public library, and I'm responsible for the website. And my question today is, I'm in the midst of redesigning the teen pages, and I wanted some tips and ideas on what I could consider or take into consideration. I'm trying to push our resources to the teens, and currently our teen section is not very exciting, and if anybody has any tips or ideas, I've been also looking at different websites from other libraries, but I don't think they are any better than what we have. So any ideas, I'd appreciate it.
We actually just redesigned our teens website last year. A colleague of mine, Maggie Baxter, played a big part in that. And the great thing about Maggie is that she's really good at going out and talking to the teens and finding out what they want. And she would actually go to our branches and take some screenshots of a wireframe or a prototype that we'd come up with for the site. And she'd sit it down in front of them and say, what do you think of this? You know, if you were using this, what do you think? And a lot of times, you know, oh, this sucks, or, you know, I don't like this, or I like that. But it gave her that insight, you know, that usability that we sort of needed to, you know, from their angle. There's a blog on our teen page that Maggie also maintains, and she's really good at asking open-ended questions. And the comments, sometimes we receive almost hundreds of comments on a single post, and the teens will start responding to each other. So I think maybe one piece of advice you might want to do is try to get out there where the teens are and see what they're using, see what they're doing, see how they're using your website right now, and maybe what they would like to see to make it better. I think just talking to them, I think that's one of the best things you can probably do.
Seconded.
Yeah, and to build on that, not only do you need to make sure that they're involved in the process, but you also need to let them contribute to the content, because these teenagers today know the technology better than any of us in this room. So we have to keep that in mind, that they know the technology. We just want to find out what they want us to do so we can do it.
One last note about that. In allowing the teens to contribute the content, we allow them to upload photos. They can put their poems on there. They can put stories on there. One of our branches recently had a poetry contest, and we published the winners online, and the teens were able to submit their poems online. So that allowing them to actually see their stuff up there, they just think that's great.
Good responses, team.
Hi, I'm Diane. I'm from Suffolk County, New York. And I'd like to know when you think it's time to stop trying to drag the non-believers into the 21st century and Web 2.0. How long should you keep trying?
The year 3000, maybe? Well, they say the world's going to end in 2012, so after that, technically. No, but I don't think... My mom is 60 years old, and I was able to convince her a couple of years ago to get into the web. And, you know, I sat down and had some discussions with her and showed her some things. And she's come around. She's actually nearly a computer programmer. I mean, she's really turned around in a couple of years' time. So I don't think it's ever too late. I think we need to continue to try to keep people going in that direction. I'm not saying drag them kicking and screaming, but help them along the way and help.
I'm talking about library administrators.
Oh, you're saying library administrators?
It's harder when they make more money than you do to tell them what to do. But to me, not being up on these technologies, not being aware of how your community is using them, and not wanting to take advantage of that should not be allowed. I don't think that it's acceptable for staff to not want to learn this stuff, to not want to have those skills. There's skill sets that we absolutely demand from our staff in a lot of areas. To do this job, you have to be able to do this. And this is an area that they have to be proficient in order to do their jobs well. And unfortunately, I will say I've had the same experience of meeting quite a few people who are still kicking and screaming and don't want to learn, don't want to think about it. And they happen to be in positions of power in a lot of cases, and that's very difficult. The best thing that I've found for that is to show examples of other libraries who are successfully using that and connect them up with the administrator at that library to talk to them about any concerns or fears they might have. And there are a lot of people who are using the technology as well who would be happy to try to drag somebody else along kicking and screaming.
My experience with administrators, and there probably are some out here, is that you have to convince them it was their idea. Remember when you said you wanted to learn about Web 2.0 technologies? But the other thing I would say, and I don't know how well this works at the administrative level, but in general, my experience is that where people fail is where they try to convince other people that it's about the library and how the library can benefit. And what really works is making those technologies meaningful for the people that you're talking to. That's tricky, and it's a twist on how you actually present that material. But I find it's infinitely more effective if they walk away thinking about how RSS is actually going to change their lives on a personal level, and not even necessarily about how it's going to change their work behaviors, but that how it really takes it to a whole nother level outside of their day job.
Zeth has a comment. Oh, after you, Joy.
I'm going to let him speak first. Go.
And if you need to, you can kind of appeal to their shallow sense of prestige. You know, I mean, the Library Journal Mover and Shakers list just came out, and how many of those people are there because they're using technology, because they're moving forward into the 21st century?
And I don't know if any of you caught our presentation that Sam and I did, but we recently implemented a program called Learn and Play at CML, which is based on Helen's Learning 2.0 program. And we have our executive leadership team, almost every single member except for, I think, one person is blogging. And I think it's put the responsibility on them that when the staff see that you are active and you are supporting this and you are encouraging them to do it, they then come aboard. And a lot of our managers, supervisors have found that when they just humble themselves a little bit, if they don't get something, they aren't understanding something, if they ask one of their staff members for help, it empowers that staff member, it makes them feel better, it makes the manager look better, and that just, I think, feeds all the way right up to the top. So we've sort of, in order to support this program, in order to get our administrative support, we sort of had to let them know that, you know, unless you're supporting this, unless you're doing this, actually doing it, the rest of the staff aren't going to want to.
Yeah, I think to surmise, it's all about showing the value of what you're giving your patrons and what your staff is getting from it.
Let me say, tomorrow, the end of the problem-solving track is going to be a similar arrangement to this, and the topic is going to be getting buy-in for cool technology projects. So there will be more on this topic that you can listen to. Who's next? We have time for a few more questions. I'm doing a lot of walking here, huh?
Hi, my name's Mike. I'm from the Glencoe Public Library in Glencoe, Illinois. I have a question for you about the social catalog, which I actually haven't heard anyone talk about yet today, but I might have just gone to the wrong presentations. But one of the things I struggle with as my library thinks about implementing this over our catalog is right now there are so many places where you can do this kind of stuff online. you can do this stuff on Amazon, you know, library thing. There's all these kind of social networks for posting about books. My hometown, which isn't the town I work in, just got a social catalog on top of their catalog, and you know, I struggle with why I should be posting there rather than somewhere else. I wonder if you could address this, you know, as for why public libraries need to get into this type of thing.
One thing to keep in mind sometimes is that a lot of times the public, your average customer, thinks of your catalog as your website. They may not realize all the other great things that you have going on. They want to know where their books are. And many times they might bookmark right to your catalog page, and that's their library page right there. So if you have users that are doing that, you have to be there to reach out to them and to, you know, to be aware of what they're doing and let them know that you're there too. So, I mean, that's just, you know, maybe one thing you might think of.
And I would add that for some people, the public library is the most community, local community-oriented web presence and web community that they're familiar with. And so I think that some people will find a different kind of value, for instance, sharing reviews amongst their local, you know, geographically local online community, as opposed to throwing reviews out on Amazon. I think I'm always surprised at how people value the library website as a local web presence in that way.
I know some of the vendors out there, like I believe Aqua Browser, they're working on creating mechanisms to aggregate all this social information. So maybe in a year or so, this won't even be an issue. Who knows?
Right, and if you do use like Library Thing for libraries, you're actually pulling in all of the Library Thing reviews into your catalog, and then if people want to write reviews, they can go create a Library Thing account and do that, and that's fine. To me, the aggregation is key, because unless people see a lot of reviews for a lot of books, it's not going to be something that they're going to want to contribute to or even think to contribute to. It's almost like, you know, the rise in participation is extremely steep very quickly, but it once it gets there, but it takes a while for the momentum to build and the word to pass that this is something that people will want to spend time on. I'm worried about a lot of the products that are out there that just isolate your library, or your library's comments are shared with the other people who subscribe to that product only. I mean, we have all these little kind of silos of reviews because of the way that the products are built, and I don't know how that's going to resolve itself in the end, but it doesn't seem like a good thing.
I need to plug John Blyberg's talk tomorrow. He's going to be talking about SOPAC 2.0, so for more on this issue, definitely listen to him. His product, his open source overlay is genius, and it solves that very problem that you were talking about, Sarah. So I'll give you a cliffhanger there.
If I could follow up, there's also, you know, some of the stuff that you've mentioned, I thought of, but also, you know, I work in a very small community. It's a community of 9,000. My community, it's also, I'm on the north shore of Chicago, which has a number of suburbs. You know, that's a community for my users. Chicagoland is a community, and then, of course, you know, there's a bigger community outside of that. So it's another thing I struggle with all these different communities that are our users.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I was trying to kind of say something, but it wasn't completely linked to that one. One part that could answer your question, the thing we're interested in Delft is, if you want to write a piece about a book or about a CD, I want to know, if I write it, I want to know where it gets to. If in high school I would buy a CD and would tell all my friends, okay, I bought a new CD, it's really cool, you need to get it. And that part in describing what you think about the book, about the story, about the music, and getting it out to the people you want them to read can help develop it. If a kid from high school thinks the CD is cool, he writes it probably because he wants to tell it to his friends. He's not going to tell it to all the to everyone in the library. He wants to drop the message that the people are important to them. And at this moment, we're looking how to get to that stage.
Just to turn the community, the multiple communities thing back on itself, I think the interesting thing is that people have demonstrated that they're not only capable
of participating in multiple communities, that they embrace it and that they love it. And so I don't particularly get too concerned about the over proliferation of communities. It seems like people are happy to be part of as many communities as are relevant and meaningful to them as they possibly can be.
Okay, before I walk up front, any questions back here? If I walk away, someone will raise their hand. I think we have time for one more question, so who's it going to be? I didn't even have to get to my list, so...
Or we could break early for...
We could get a key drinks. Spot in line for refreshments. Oh! All right.
All right. If you only could pick one social media tool to live with, just one, which one would it be? Because there's lots of them out there.
I would say Flickr. Greatest UI ever.
But I don't have to. Isn't that the point? And that's my answer.
Okay, I'm going to say Flickr, too.
I would say Facebook, actually. There's a huge community there for my family and my friends, and it works really well for me.
I go with Sarah. Facebook, the same.
I'm also Facebook.
I'd actually like to amend my answer to suggest that there aren't actually any social media tools that I couldn't live without, and that every time I try to turn them off for a week, I don't really have any problem with that.
Let's give them all a round of applause. They did a great job.